You're watching Deprogrammed. This is the New Culture Forum show, committed to fighting back against the forces of ideological conformity, particularly among the young. My name's Harrison Pitt. I'm a senior editor at the European Conservative, and I'm thrilled to be joined today, as ever, by Evan Riggs, who is a freelance journalist. And since young people matter, and half of them are women, we thought we'd get on this week an intelligent representative of both her sex and her generation, Fleur Elizabeth Meston, prolific on Twitter, contributor to The Critic magazine, and co-host of Bombshells, a new show in which guests are given a bit of a grilling by two young conservative women. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah.
Didn't, yes, that's about right. I think I've covered all bases there. So I suppose J.K. Rowling's been in the news lately. She's been tempting Humza Yousaf, First Minister of Scotland, to arrest her under the new hate speech law that's come into effect there beginning of this month. Do you think that this that the transgender movement is having a positive effect in one sense, and that it's actually radicalising women, and many of whom are young?
Yeah, definitely. I know that my few female conservative friends, small C conservative, of course. They really found their route into the right through trans issues because my co-host Amy from Bombshells, this is what got her into politics, like passionately. It's her hill that she'll die on because it personally affects women. Like, we are having our spaces invaded. We're not that I'm a sporty person, but it's not succeeding in sports because you've got men with a huge physical advantage taking over. So it's like an immediate threat. And although people will argue against that, saying they are, what, 0.1% of the population or something? Yes, that may be 0.1%, but tell that to someone who has been sexually assaulted by a trans woman. I think I read something horrifying the other day that half of transgender prison inmates are in there for sexual offences. So that 0.1% sounds small, but that 50% or almost 50% of prison inmates being sexual offenders is terrifying. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's like a threat to women, as and it's like a completely unique thing in that.
It certainly has radicalized a lot of people, and there's been a very strange, there's a bit of a strange bedfellows effect. In the same way that during lockdown, all of a sudden people like Lord Sumption and Russell Brand are on the same team. You get weird, and there's been a similar thing going on where you've got people like Julie Bindle with a history of writing articles titled "Why I Hate Men." You know, not a typical conservative person. You completely united with someone like Douglas Murray or someone like, you know.
Well, it doesn't sound like Julie Bindle's changed all that much.
Yes, that's true. That's a good point. It comes to the question of the consistency here. And I wonder whether... So on the one hand, this is I wonder what you think about this. On the one hand, it's clearly a cause for rejoicing because, you know, numbers matter in this game. And if you can unite J.K. Rowling and Nigel Farage on an issue, then, you know, you can have an impact. But is there a risk as well that we glorify the TERFs a little bit too much and forget some of their earlier crusades?
This is true, yeah. I mean, so I was brought up not allowed to read or watch Harry Potter.
Because of witchcraft?
Exactly, yeah. So
I thought that was a uniquely American phenomenon.
The Americans have said this to me, and I actually don't know anyone else, even children I went to church with, they were allowed to watch it. But my dad studied theology, and he really knows his stuff. And I was sort of raised kind of evangelical. So, J.K. Rowling wasn't a good person in my childhood, I was taught. I actually did watch Harry Potter...
On the sly.
2 years ago.
Oh, you did? Oh, I see.
Absolutely loved it. It's so good.
Does your father know?
Yeah, he's a bit disappointed.
He's made his peace with it, I suppose. Hopefully.
Yeah, I'm an adult now, so... and also, you know, there are rumours about... sort of being involved in satanic stuff, like on a more serious level. And I do find that it is very easy for people to think, oh, someone agrees with me on this cause, and this is a really current issue. And so, yes, they're our person now, and forget about their history. Something I definitely think you should be wary of. Before you align yourself with someone, really think, do we align on all of these things? Like Graham Linehan, like he's great on the trans stuff, but I read his Wikipedia page and found that he'd been very passionately advocating for abortion, which is something that I am totally against. So I don't see myself as a fan of him because of that, because personally, abortion comes higher in my
hierarchy. This is something I actually wanted to ask you, Fleur, which is that, you know, this is kind of what broke apart the intellectual dark web, which is like, we all hate wokeism, we're all anti-woke, but we'll splinter when we try to figure what we're actually for. Mm. And I mean, it's all well and good to say like, okay, we're all very anti, you know, trans men beating up young girls in an octagon or something. But does that actually make you pro women? Or are you anti-trans? Is there a difference there?
Difference between pro women and anti-trans? No, because there will definitely, right, you know, the manosphere, a lot of them do genuinely dislike women and take a lot of opportunities to just belittle women online, doing whole threads on why women are basically just useful for sex. But those same people will be completely anti-trans because to them it's disgusting and perverted.
Mm-hmm. So there is a difference, then.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
And so we shouldn't be, in other words, we shouldn't be, I think this is a weakness that conservatives have generally. We find ourselves, small c, always, we find ourselves so
marginalized
and sort negging of, for scraps.
Thirsty. That, like, someone can put up a little morsel of meat and we're just, we sort of gorge on it and, you know, get lots of satisfaction out of that. My main fear is that people like, Kathleen Stock is another one of the TERFs, is a decent philosopher. Her book is very sort of philosophically and conceptually thorough on I should forget what his title is, but is it sort of girls? Never mind. But these people are going to drop us up, people like us, like a hot potato, as soon as we start talking about things that really, well, not that trans doesn't matter, but it's not the only thing that matters. And that's my concern. There's also the point as well that even if, I think it's perfectly possible to be, for example, for, I don't know, gay marriage and against trans. So I talk about earlier crusades that these people have been fighting, but there is a sense in which they do come from the same conceptual place. This sort of is what Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, calls expressive individualism, this idea that we kind of curate and define our own reality. Those sorts of arguments were used to justify earlier phases of the social liberal revolution. And in many ways, people like Kathleen Stock, these are just people who think that their co-religionists went one crusade too far. And I wonder whether we should be entrenching that language of expressive individualism that they care about, or whether we should be challenging it more deeply. A good example of it would be, I brought this here today because I think it's very indicative. The cult of expressive individualism reminds me of this quote from a judge, I think it was written by Anthony Kennedy in the case Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, where the judge in question says, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." That cult of expressive individualism is like, it completely pervades our culture. And it's the same, it was exactly those sorts of resources that people like Kathleen Stock would have been drawing on in earlier phases of the social liberal revolution. But they're just sort of reluctant about where its logic is heading. I wonder how you think we should be addressing this at a deeper level, or just purely focusing on day-to-day political manifestations of these sorts of things.
So I wrote, it's about a similar topic in an article that, well, it started off as a Russian model who had fell to her death in suspicious circumstances, but it's thought to be a suicide. And she had been taken at a young age from her hometown, I think was in Ukraine, but she was Russian-Ukrainian, and sort of thrust into this stardom with lots of parties, champagne, cocaine, and had no connection to her background, and it was a completely alien world, and she felt like she had no sense of identity and went to this very strange cult-like course where they try and give you a new identity. And in present day, there's a lot of people who feel like that aren't sort of entrenched in a community in the way that they were in the past, and then look for any way to define themselves, whether that's gender or race or sex or whatever, and really it's not enough to give you satisfaction And one of my heroes, Jordan Peterson, says that you have to be embedded in layers of family, community, nation, religion. I feel like I'm missing one, but that's always in the back of my mind. Like, those are the core things that will hold you together and give you an identity. And it's not all about yourself. It never works. Like, society never works when you focus just on yourself. And yeah, that is like, selfishness is not getting anyone anywhere.
No.
You have to be part of something to succeed. If everyone's trying to do the best themselves, that you won't get anywhere.
Yeah, so this is the point. I wonder whether, even when we side with people like Stock, whether we're, and which we should do, I'm not saying I'm against doing that on this point, but I wonder, at a deeper level, I fear that we're entrenching certain ways of thinking that go against that sort of very embedded picture of what it is to be a human being that you're talking about there.
It reminds me of Nicolas Soldo's review of Louise Perry's book, Case Against the Sexual Revolution, where he basically says, you know, all this is well and good. This is all very, very great advice. But the problem is you can't, you know, people are going to fight off being subsumed under these layers or chained to the earth, you know, brought back down to human level under the current political system, which is basically, you know, Luis, yes, you're right. But if you actually want this stuff, it's going to take a lot more than, you know, writing a book or going on podcasts. You're probably going to have to change the entire political paradigm.
Indeed.
Which I don't think is likely to happen soon, but she might get her way in a couple of decades.
Yes.
Until then, it's going to be a pretty uphill battle.
Yeah, well, this is why the culture war is important. Like, the most instructive statement on this being Andrew Breitbart's, when he famously said that politics is downstream of culture. And people who are policy wonks, like, well represented by the kind of people you get in the IA and the Adam Smith Institute, and think that if only we could, like, get this policy through about sort of, you know, cutting capital gains tax, everything would be fine. Like, all of our policy discussions, they're always downstream of earlier developments that have gone. And if you're not attentive to those sort of cultural framework within which politics takes place, you're not going to be a very effective politicker.
I think politics is downstream from culture, but they're both downstream from tech. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Fleur, is, do you think, you know, because you're very sort of pronatalism, pro-family, what do you make of the sort of recent advances in, you know, not only fertility technology, but also, you know, gene editing babies, or like Gattaca babies, which we're starting to have now, or especially, you know, on the question of sort of surrogacy, which has started to come up a lot in conservative circles, and abortion on exogenous wombs, which are apparently actually starting to take place. Do you think, here's my question to you, do you think that it is maybe in conservatives' best interest to actually start becoming, and I'm going to use a slightly provocative word here, but it is probably the most honest one, eugenical, and adopting this technology to, you know, kind of further their own ends and bring about more children?
No, I don't think that's conservative. I think things like, people will make this argument that if you are pronatalist, then why are you anti-surrogacy? Yeah. Like, there is a design that has worked since time began, and that is getting married and having children in a natural way, and that worked. So what, like, obviously there are so many barriers to having children in your prime, especially, but these things aren't the answer. And I think I actually just recently rewatched My Sister's Keeper. I don't know if you've seen that.
What is it? No, I've not seen it. Tell our audience.
I have seen the movie, unfortunately.
Very sad film, which I first watched in RE in like year 9 or something. Okay. Because it's about a family. They have a young daughter who's maybe 4 or 5 who gets leukemia, and they say they've tried everything. The only answer is to have a baby, take the stem cells, and then she will give bone marrow throughout her life. The older sister eventually gets to the point where she's just ready to go, like, and she tells her younger sister, please, can you, like, sue our parents to the rights to your own body? I don't know if it's a true story or not, but she succeeds despite wanting her sister to live. But these are just not human activities. Mm. And the amount of pain that it causes in the film, I don't know if it's real life, but is just wrong. Like,
but do you not think we could overcome that with tech? Like, what if you had, you know, a couple in their 40s or their 50s, right wing, rich,
wants to now have a dozen kids, you know, and, you know, with gene editing, it's not like you, you know, like go and do an invasive procedure into a child, but it's more like you select embryos, you know, to make them, you know, less likely to become diseased or more likely to be high IQ, you know, with the exogenous womb things that people are talking about now, which is like, you don't have a person as a surrogate, but it's artificial. Do you not think that we can embrace this technology to then basically have like a pronatal revolution?
Well, in that circumstance, a couple in their 40s and 50s, I think it is unfair to bring a baby into the world who in their 30s will lose their parents. And that's a time, that's an age when you will be having a young family yourself, hopefully, and you would really need to draw on your parents for their experience, their support, childcare, because childcare is very expensive. Also, just as a Christian, this is, to me, seems like playing God.
Would you still say that about, like, Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Mick Jagger having kids in their, like, 70s now? With, like, 20-year-old wife?
It's so selfish.
They'll be taken care of. They'll have tons of money. I
have a family member who, where she was 21 and her dad was 88. And he dies and she... Didn't see her get married, graduate, have grandchildren, and now she's in her mid-20s without a dad. I just think it's incredibly selfish.
The sort of stuff you're talking about, like, it just completely blows natural human proportions to shreds in a way which I think is very alienating for the real temper of human life to which we're accustomed. And I think the main point that we should be stressed here is that maybe the Brave New World being outlined in Evan's mind here
I think it's inevitable.
You asked Paul Moreland about it, and he was equally suspicious of it. I think that the main point we want to stress is that, at least, what the point you made, like, we want, it's not as though we don't have the natural equipment for this. In many ways, it's human beings playing God, which has got us into this mess in the first place. The kind of the step change in technology that took place with the invention of the pill, which is, we're now learning, has all sorts of deleterious effects on how women are attracted to things. The point problem with playing God is that you're never going to do it very well, and it seems to me that we'd be much better off relying on what we already have, as opposed to trying to embark on some Brave New World. I think that is the properly conservative thing to do.
We haven't been able to do that for 60 years, so what are you going to do? Like, have some sort of, like, Butlerian jihad where you blow up all the pill manufacturing plants? Like, what is the other solution?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
the technology exists, but you just, like, tell people, like, don't you dare use it. How is that going for phones?
For phone?
Yeah.
It's true, but technology needs to be tamed by... technology is not an intrinsic evil, but it's not an intrinsic good either, and any society which is intent on making sure that technology is something it does rather than something that happens to it needs to be in control, and that will often include regulations. The talk of the Brave New World along these lines completely scares the heebie-jeebies out of me, and also the openness to abuse as well by powerful actors. I just think it the truly conservative thing to do is to engage the precautionary principle on this and take the lead from other countries which are benefit from technology, like Israel, but which still have high rates of, high birth rates. Also, there's the Eric Kaufman point that, over time, it's likely that this sort of penchant, which we've developed over the last 60 years for being antinatalist, will kind of edit itself out of the gene pool, because all of the people who haven't been having babies don't have babies. All the people who have been having babies have babies and pass on those values and those norms and those structures. So I think it's still an open question as to whether it's inevitable, but it's certainly something that people are going to have to grapple with and talk about.
I think it may be oversimplifying it, but I do just think having proper family policy would do wonders. And also, I don't know, not importing 700,000 people a year. So, like, that there's the infrastructure for people to have children, because if you currently know the state of, like, can't get a GP appointment, there's queues down the street when a new dentist opens, schools are full, the NHS is at breaking point.
There's also that intrinsic feeling that
that I think is not always very well expressed by people, but there is some evidence to suggest that high rates of immigration affect natalism precisely because people don't feel as though they'd be bringing up their children in a place they can call home anymore.
Well,
because
yeah,
you've got the world on your doorstep.
Always on my mind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, it must be.
Yeah.
And we could maybe get into this a bit. Like, you've always been, the first time I met you, can I share that story?
Yeah, I think it's a great story, yeah. Yeah.
So we were working at Tesco together in the Northeast, and I saw Fleur reading the Telegraph in the staff room, and I was completely astonished by it, and I started quizzing her. She was actually quite nervous. You were quite nervous, weren't you? Because you assumed I was one of those sort of radical students that was wondering why the hell are you sort of filling your brain with that bilge.
I thought you were going to tell me to read like The Guardian.
Yeah, exactly. And then I found out that you actually have from a very young age, you've always wanted to be first and foremost a mother. So this came naturally to you. How do you think you slipped the net?
How do I
think you slipped the net? Why are you not like everyone else on this point?
I mean, I credit a lot to my upbringing. My mum was one of six, and I don't know. My mum said that from 2 years old, she'd take me to playgroup, and the only things that I'd play with were the baby dolls in the toy kitchen. and then I just remember my whole childhood dolls. And as soon as I was 12, I wanted to help in the crèche at my church.
Yeah.
And I've just always had this instinct to mother. Yeah. And I really do not want to sound like a pick me girl, but like, it must just be biological. And for generations, like, people have had that instinct. But it's all, when I think of the future and people have said, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Or where's your career heading? I'm like, my career is a necessity because you can't survive on one income, really, with a family these days. But my first and foremost, all I want to do is to be a mum. And I kind of mold my life around that goal. So it's really great for me to have that goal to head towards, because I do feel like a lot of young women who have grown up with the girl boss image and shows like Sex and the City and magazines telling you like female empowerment and casual dating and your career is everything, have been brainwashed to think being a mum isn't enough. Whereas to me, it's like the most, that's everything.
So yeah, this is something that I asked Louise Perry, but she's in a very different position with now having had a child, which is that, you know, I really worry actually about like sort of what the punishment that is going to be inflicted upon society is going to be from a lot of women who are now coming into maybe their late 30s to 40s or even in their 20s, still able to have kids, but are just not going to get there. When they basically get later on in life and realize like this like massive aspect of what it means to be human or to be a woman has been kind of stolen away from me on this like pack of lies. And I you know, I think it's very, you know, it'd be nice for us to think like nothing will happen because of that. But I don't think that's true, because it's going to be such a significant portion of the population by all any metric that we can see. What do you think will be the effect of this, of the first generation in human history to have a significant portion of women who wanted to have kids and couldn't?
It's hard to say, but what I would hope would be that it would be an example to the next generation to not leave it so late. And, you know, that doesn't mean settling for the wrong man, but not thinking my career now, that later, and thinking that they are equally important. I would say that building a relationship and finding the right father for your children is more important, because that is what continues humankind.
Humankind? At least you didn't say people kind.
What would you say?
The rules are different. No, it's fine. Humankind's fine.
Being woke?
Mankind's the base reason, I think.
Mankind. Sorry. And just being a feminist for a minute.
Quite. Lapsing into old habits. You know, but do you think, but one thing that could potentially challenge your thesis that this is a natural drive that people have,
I think it's
to have kids.
Yeah,
is
no,
that really a thesis?
I know. And today that's no real. Gosh, interesting idea. Let me
mine a right wing podcast.
let me mull on that. But I suppose the question would be: like, clearly, you want to continue. You're saying that there are a lot of obstacles and structures in the way of people having children.
Yeah,
that's true. Clearly, but when Louise Perry was on here, she made a point which is difficult to argue against. It's not as though for all of human history the odds have been ultra favorable. Like, you know, if anything, this is one of the most privileged times in history in which to bring up, into which to live at all, let alone bring up a child. And you know, we are members of a species which has struggled through so much more than, you know, the two income trap. So that didn't have a sort of seismic effect on people's propensity to have children. This is where the technology clearly matters more, I would say, than the way that society is structured.
This is my point. This is what I mean.
No, politics, you're right.
And culture are both downstream of tech, and you know, you can basically, maybe you can become ultra authoritarian and, you know, stop the certain progression of certain technologies, shut down the pill plants. But outside of that, I think I don't consider myself conservative, just right wing. Mm. But as right wingers, need to adopt pronatalist technology and embrace it completely, because I don't think there's any other choice. I think, you know, we'll just end up getting left behind.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not completely sure about that.
I think there are other choices.
Yeah, well, I think there were plenty of first world countries. Well, not plenty, that's not true. But that there are some first world countries which managed to, to have healthy sort of above replacement birth rates without.
There's one.
Israel.
It's literally one.
I think what we need to do, I think that everything you say is true, but I wouldn't agree entirely with the point about technology being the real arbiter. Like, technology certainly like deals the cards, but how you play them is still a question of culture, a question of values, a question of spirit. And I think the reason why the Israelis don't need to go down this path, which we're wondering whether it might be inevitable here, is precisely because they have a strong spirit. They have a sense of national identity. Clearly religious purpose comes into it. They have a sense of themselves as living in history. It's understandable when you're sort of, you know, surrounded by enemies on all sides in that way. And I think if we were to revive a spirit like that in Britain, then I think that the perceived need for any kind of technological.
Look, I think you're right. Which is more likely to happen?
Oh, possibly. Yeah. I would fight against it, though. I suspect Flo would.
Well, I would argue that that's a bit of a defeatist attitude. And
there'd be more kids. They'd be right wing. They'd be smarter.
But as Harrison said, it could easily be abused. You think how many single mothers haven't found the right man and think, I will use technology to have a child on my own. And, you know, the statistics show that that's not the ideal family setup. Yeah, and or same-sex couples who use surrogates, and then that baby's taken from its mother. So, yeah, I think the ideal is still the traditional family structure.
I'm not arguing with that. I'm just saying, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Like, here's let's pose a hypothetical to you. I was talking to some gay conservatives, and you know, we were talking about they wanted to have kids, and they're asking me about surrogacy, and I said, look, you know, it's not really up for me to say. There's a lot I don't know about it. I would just prefer adoption.
Exactly the same. And a child with two parents of the same sex is so much more preferable to a child with no family stuck in a children's home.
Where is the line that separates that from having, let's say, like an exogenous womb?
Well, there definitely is a line. The line is that in the one instance with adoption, you're addressing a situation which has already happened, that you haven't engineered, which already exists in the society. It exists. It's downstream from human folly and human failure generally, or indeed tragedy if the parents have died in a car accident, whatever it might be, and you're doing your best to repair and address a situation imperfectly. In the other case, you are deliberately engineering a situation in which the child, future child, has no say, in which they're sort of forcibly estranged through human design from their natural biological mother, and I think that would be a pretty good distinction to draw.
It also is, like, I'd say mainly that baby probably doesn't know that it's not with its biological mother, mm-hmm. but the mother knows, and she will, as much as she might deny it, live with that trauma for the rest of her life.
Indeed.
Yeah. I'm just going to make the slightly pedantic point that I agree on this, but that's not exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about artificial wombs, which I think are coming. There is no mother.
There is no mother.
There is no mother. It's like Gattaca movies. It's like gene editing. It's like.
But there is no other alternative. So the child can't even seek out their mother when they do want to find out who their mother's identity is in 30 years' time, which is something which I'm imagining probably. I don't even know how far advanced the technology is in terms of. Also, how long. If we've been doing surrogacy long enough that there are surrogate babies in their 30s today who are genuinely curious to know who their biological mother is, I'm sure that must be something that comes to people. Mm. But I mean, I'd think that. In this case, you'd have people like that who didn't even have a mother to seek out and have a real relationship with.
What kind of people do you think will be using these wombs?
The Chinese.
The Chinese are
not the kind of people. They definitely will, but that's because they embrace the idea at the outset of an ultra-planned authoritarian society in which technology is completely at the service.
I know that this might sound like some like sci-fi mumbo jumbo to our audience, but I want to like be clear, like this is not like a hypothetical technology. This is literally being developed.
This is not an idea. And I think the point about it not being the ideal, I understand that you're not saying recommending this as an, you're just saying this is something which is going to be coming
whether we like it or
whether
not.
Whether we like it or not.
So we might as well make the best of it.
So that's the bit that I'm questioning. I think that there are other options which are more compatible with human flourishing to sort of solving this situation that don't involve going down that route, which is going to be a very difficult one to reverse if we do end up living in such a brave new world.
Yeah, I agree. But if they're going to exist and it's inevitable, like you say, then personally, I don't think it's a very conservative thing to do. But, you know, should be a free world for people to make their own decisions.
What do you think? So if we're not going down the Brave New World utopia for Evan, dystopia for us. Okay. if we don't go down that avenue, what do you think would make a measurable difference? Probably not to you, because as you said, you're someone who's for whom that has always been front and center, the idea of having children.
Yeah.
What at the level of policy? What sort of things do you have? Girlfriends, presumably. What do you think would make a measurable difference to their outlook on this question?
On having children.
Yeah, having children, and because I think it's generally in that environment that you are going to get women being probably more conservative. If women who have children are much more conservative than single women.
Just mimic the Hungarian government, everyone.
There's that.
Copy and paste.
It actually hasn't noticeably increased their birth rate, but it's new. But I would say that most of my female friends who say, I want to have a career first, most of my female friends who aren't as into having children as I am say that they want to have a career. And there's, I don't know, making it financially possible to have children, and even the Hungarian policy, you get tax breaks, but you still have childcare costs, which I don't know what they're like in Hungary. I expect they're a lot
cheaper,
but in the UK, they're astronomical. Mm-hmm. And to have one child in a nursery, I think the average is around £1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. Then you add on 2-3. For people who don't like the way that state education's going and think, well, I would like to put my children into a private school, if you're spending that much even in preschool, you think how much like that's taking away from your budget for that. Or as a lot of people are thinking, homeschooling to try and avoid the indoctrination as much as possible. How can you do that on one income? Like, something's got to change in the culture of finances for families.
Yeah.
And I know that the Labour government, they want to just make it cheaper to put your children into early years education, but that's taking them away from their mother, who, you know, I used to be a nursery teacher. I don't know if I've told you that before.
I'm not shocked to hear that.
And I would spend more time with these babies than they spent with their parents.
Which is good for you, but
I loved it.
Poor babies there, you know? I mean, not because you're bad, but because, you know, baby needs its mother's attention.
There was one little boy who was, I know you're not supposed to have favourites, but he was just, he was my angel. He would cry when he would get picked up, and it broke my heart. I loved him so much, but I saw him, especially his parents weren't together, so they alternated weekends. And I was his, I think my title was his key carer, but I really was the main adult in his life. And
it's not how, not tenderly really how it should be.
You shouldn't, it's a sad world when you have a child and you are not, they are their main influence and their main carer.
Well, a friend of the show, Connor Tomlinson, recently wrote a piece for the European Conservative about this called The Daycare Industrial Complex. Well, some kind of, I'm probably butchering the title a bit, but just type in Connor Tomlinson, European Conservative, if you want to find out about any documents. The myriad studies demonstrating that not only is this just a bit of a heartbreak on the sidelines to look at a baby boy wanting its mother, obviously that's up, but he might think, oh, well, he won't remember in 10 years, who cares? It does actually have measurable effects on the way in which people, anxiety disorders and all these sorts of other things kind of coming down the pike. This is something we should think about seriously. And I think that the one key sort of fundamental change that needs to happen in our approach is that, and this is also a point that Connor makes in his article, and I agree with it, is that we need to completely roll back. It goes back to what I was saying about expressive individualism earlier. We need to completely roll back on the idea that the fundamental unit in any society is the sort of undifferentiated, atomized individual. Like, we need to restore an understanding that a nation is a collective and it's composed primarily of units which are best considered on the familial level. And if we think that if all of our sort of policy discussions are oriented around what can we do for the family rather than what can we do for the sort of upwardly mobile, profit-seeking, profit-maximizing individual, I think a lot of these problems would probably solve themselves at some level. Not solve themselves, but the paradigm for the discussion would be much more fruitful.
The best functioning society I've ever visited, and I've not traveled extensively, but when I went to Taiwan, my mind was blown by what is possible. But they, in East Asia, family is everything, and not just family, but your ancestry, because they want to honor their ancestors, and they go to temples and leave. They left like bags of Doritos, and
it was really eccentric. Yeah.
But having that thing of we should honour them, and I think how many people today are honouring the things that their ancestors did. I mean, I've come nowhere close to what mine did.
Well, actively repudiated. Yeah. A lot of them hate their ancestors.
Yeah.
Without knowing anything about them.
It's I think 95% of people in Taiwan practice a religion. So there's two things, family and religion. And then Taiwan obviously has its history. And so there's that nationhood that they also are embedded in. And everyone respects each other so much. And they respect where they live. It's spotless. They, people would never push in front of you to get on the subway, which my biggest hate in London is I'm getting off the tube and someone's getting on before I'm off it. And it's just such a pleasant place to visit that I was there for 2 weeks and I feel homesick for it because it was just that amazing.
I have a feeling, and I suspect our audience might as well, that Evan's about to bring up Singapore.
No, you're not going to bring up the Chinese once again, which is that, much like Israel, Taiwan is also a culture under immense pressure.
Indeed.
And that they have to have this sort of... what would you call it? Existential. It's top down, but it's also bottom up. Sense of community, because at any point they're worried about a bunch of boats coming in off the wake. Helps. That helps engender a feeling of solidarity with your country,
like the Blitz spirit.
Yeah, quite. And we're still suffering. I think in many ways, like a great way of sort of summing up what the culture war is fundamentally, it's a kind of indulgence. A sort of indulgent navel gazing, which is a symptom of a hangover of the whole end of history stuff that went on. If you think the history is an end, then you can relax a bit and you can focus on bathrooms and all that sort of stuff. But I suppose the last question, we started with whether the style trans movement would be radicalizing women we found that to be inadequate in some ways because the principles at work are not always ideal, but it's no secret that we're not quite as bad as South Korea. South Korea has the worst gender divide in the world in terms of like political outlook.
I think it's the worst birth rate in the world.
I don't think that's a coincidence. Yeah, exactly. That's true. It's one, well, I don't know if they're the worst, but they're certainly up there as one of the worst. Women and men are just completely at loggerheads in terms of the cultural and political views that they have. That's developing among the Zoomers now. On the graph, there's clearly a very severe gender divide between young men who are sort of tending more conservative, not completely conservative, but more conservative, and young women who are still very sort of... How do you think we can best go about bringing the sexes together again to inhabit a shared sort of patriotic, culturally conservative outlook? It's a tiny question to end with there.
Yeah, really easy.
Bomb
one.
The door pass.
Right. I actually was reading about this as I was having my hair done this morning. It was in The Economist. I don't know if you saw the story about the divide. What really struck me was in all of the countries listed. I think there was Australia, Britain, UK, Poland, South Korea, maybe a couple of others. The chart went from 0 to 10. So 10 is very conservative, 0 is very liberal. None of these countries went above 5, which is like, this is a worldwide thing that we have all become more liberal, men and women in all different age groups. And, you know, why is that? I think a lot of it comes from the aftermath of World War II. That a lot of authoritarianism, which led to the French philosophers having this obsession with complete liberty, even with age of consent.
Laws, sort of the Simone de Beauvoir and Michel Foucault, angling for autonomy, the next front for autonomy. Yeah, yeah.
Which has influenced the world.
It's kind of infected the cultural zeitgeist.
It's a disease. But men and women... The differences, there is a chemical difference with how many young women are on contraceptive pills, which is something I'm very thankful that my mother always warned me against. I thought she's being religious and a prude, but really she was so right about the chemicals change you. And I have so many friends who have been on them from their mid-teens, come off them in their late 20s, now that there is a lot of discussion going on about it, and say they don't recognize themselves because they've been a completely different person because of these hormones, and they had no idea who they truly were, which is so scary.
Yeah, well, hopefully there is a not a majority yet, but hopefully there is a burgeoning number of young people understanding that this revolution hasn't served them particularly well, and they might be angling for a counter-revolution of sorts. Fleur, it's been a pleasure to have you on Deprogrammed. Thank you for coming on. Evan, thank you as ever. You've been watching Deprogrammed. Make sure to like, subscribe, leave a comment if you wish, and we shall see you on the next one.
Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.